You are listening to a free podcast of The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. To support the show and receive nearly an hour extra material daily, become a member today at majority.fm. Resistance is futile.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
The destiny of America is always safer in the hands of the people than in the conference rooms of any elite.
Sam Cedar.
They are unanimous in their hate for me, and I welcome their hatred.
We must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether sought or unsought, by the military-industrial complex.
The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
If I get the feeling you've been cheated.
It is Monday, September 17th, 2012, the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live to tape in the literal, though not metaphorical, shadow of the New York Times building in the fashionable Dollar Lunch District of New York City. Today on the program, Jeff Foe, the founding president and distinguished fellow of the Economic Policy Institute, on his book, The Servant Economy. Also today, reporting live to tape from the events going on around New York City to mark the one-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street, the trusty Majority Report producer squad, or at least part of them. We don't really have a name, actually, for all the producers as a squad. But let's call them producer squad. The elite squad will be out and about with their audio recording devices, and we'll put something together. I won't have heard it. It is Rosh Hashanah. As such, I am in Massachusetts with my family celebrating the Jewish New Year. However, all new interviews for you today and reports from Occupy Wall Street. For those of you who are joining us for the first time, generally we're live. Generally people listen to it as a podcast anyways. Let's not get into that. So here's an interview I did early or mid last week with Jeff Foe. He is the, like I say, the author of The Servant Economy. And then we'll hear from Matt and Michael, who have been out in the streets of New York City. Tomorrow on the program, we'll be talking to Christina Rizga from Mother Jones magazine about her piece in Mother Jones, Everything You've Heard About Failing Schools Is Wrong. I encourage you, if you're just listening to the show for the first time, check out some of our recent programs. Matt Taibbi, Glenn Greenwald, Rick Perlstein. Some of our reports from the conventions. And we'll be back live on Wednesday. Thanks for joining us. Here's that interview with Jeff Foe. We are back on The Majority Report. My name is Sam Cedar. On the phone, Jeff Foe, that's F-A-U-X, distinguished fellow at the Economic Policy Institute and author of his latest, The Servant Economy. Welcome to the program, Jeff.
Well, good to be here, Sam.
All right, so Jeff, one of the central, I guess, theses of The Servant Economy is that what we are facing now, or at least the vast majority of Americans are facing now economically, is not simply a function of the Great Recession, but maybe in some ways that the Great Recession sort of just peeled back the facade that had been maintained for decades.
Yeah, that's exactly right. Exactly right. For 30 years, the numbers have been piling up that Americans' real wages are stagnant, have been stagnant, which means that someone who is just before the great crash in 2008, someone who was, say, 35 or 40 years old with a certain education, wasn't making in real terms any more than that equivalent person back in 1979. However, all those years looked pretty good. And the reason they looked good is because, number one, family incomes kept up as families sent more people to work, mostly the wife. And number two, of course, it was debt. Incomes were stagnant, but you could go out and buy a house, buy a car, go shopping at the mall because of your credit cards and the availability of mortgage credit. That cushion deflated in 2008, 2009. And now we are facing the reality of brutal international competition and a government that over the last 30 years has done very little to increase the competitiveness and the ability of the average American to maintain living standards and compete in the world. So on our current path, I think it's pretty clear that in another 10, 12, 15 years, incomes in the United States are going to be quite a bit lower. I'd say 20% lower at least. Most people will be stuck in low-wage jobs, job insecurity, the kind of lack of upward mobility that we see among the working poor now. It's just about lower wages, but class lines under these circumstances are going to harden. And the economic evidence is in front of our eyes. The government projections, the Bureau of Labor Statistics projects occupational growth over the next 10 years and says that of the 10 occupational groups with the greatest growth, job growth, between 2010 and 2020, only one will require a four-year college education. One will require two-year college, and five, not even high school. So the idea that we have, well, things are bad and rough, but you'll make it if you go get a college education. The numbers show us that that's no longer a ticket upward.
Okay,
Yeah.
All right. Well, I'd like to go backwards a little bit first before we go any further into the future, which does not look terribly promising. But let's start with what it was that were the factors that essentially flattened out the wage growth for workers starting in the early 80s, late 70s.
Yeah. Well, I think there were three major ones. All these things, of course, have many causes, but the number one is the globalization. Not in the sense that we're in a smaller and smaller and more integrated world, but in the sense that the trade policies in the United States that we followed for the last 30 years have favored Americans who invest overseas over Americans who invest and work here. That's the big one. The second.
No, let's just stay on that for one second.
Sure.
Why don't you give me the second and the third, and then we'll go back.
Okay. The second was the dismantling of New Deal protections. And when I say that, I mean, you know, everything from the most important, I think, is the decline of labor unions. Weakening labor unions, which not only affected labor union members, but most everyone else in the economy, because of the threat that employers used to feel that, well, you know, if they didn't bargain reasonably with their employees, they'd unionize. But it also includes the cuts in the real value of the minimum wage and things of that sort. And then third, I think, has been the deregulation of finance, which shifted capital in the United States from the longer-term job-creating investments in productivity and in production and activity here to short-term speculation. Obviously, the result of that was the crash in 2008-2009.
So, all right. So let's go back now to the trade policies. I know that, I mean, so it's not really so much globalization, but it has been our response to globalization.
That's right.
I think it was under Eisenhower where there was basically a gift given to corporations as a means in which to create investment overseas, which was their capacity to defer tax payments on profits until it's repatriated.
Right.
We now have been talking about, rather than rescinding that gift, because obviously the rest of the world is certainly not in need of the same amount of development, the only time we ever even talk about that that tax dynamic is when we're talking about allowing the corporations to just keep the profits, even if no taxes, even if they repatriate it, or
just to get the money back. Yeah, right.
And
well, that's a great example, because here's a policy that was created first in the time of the Cold War, when the U.S. was using its huge market as a way to gain friends against the Soviet Union and all of that. And it was a time when, one can reasonably say that there were other countries who were flat on their back and needed to grow. But that is, that era is over. And in fact, you use the word development. I think that what is not recognized here and not discussed at all is that the United States now is, if not in need of development, in need of redevelopment. We're sort of like a developing country in the second stages. And those policies, like what we call free trade, which I think is a misnomer, but at any rate, the policies like that, policies like these, the tax policy you just mentioned, those are not only obsolete in the sense that, the world has changed, but we now need to concentrate on development here.
And so, and what other policy? I mean, obviously, we have these trade agreements like NAFTA and perhaps GATT, I guess, would fall into this as well. And they're now negotiating another one. It's more or less in secret, but from what we know of it, it seems to follow NAFTA's pattern, and maybe to a certain extent, even more extremely, the Trans-Pacific Partnership. What is it about these trade policies specifically that have really undercut the capacity for the American people to sort of increase their wages?
All right. Well, if you look closely at these agreements, what they do is provide incentives for American investors to go overseas. That's the basis of NAFTA. It's the basis of the WTO. It's the basis of the opening up to China. Originally, the argument for these groups was, well, yes, maybe at the lower ends of the wage scale, Americans will lose their jobs, but we'll all go up the global job ladder, and we'll get the high-value-added jobs. Well, after 30 years of this stuff, it's quite clear now that other countries are not satisfied with just taking a few apparel and jobs in the shoe factories. They have gone up the scale. And the United States has been running a trade deficit on high technology now for 10 years. We are right now exporting labor to countries that we keep being assured cannot compete with us. But of course, the numbers show they are competing with us. And so that the basic premise of these trade agreements has turned out to be discredited. And yet, we continue to reproduce the same things. There's a one of the books that inspired me to do this book was a book written in the 1980s by a historian named Barbara Tuchman, and it was called The March of Folly. And she showed how in history smart people and the people who are in charge of the governing class in this country are smart people, how they can keep doing the same thing over and over and over and not learning from mistakes. And trade policy is a great example about how that works in the United States.
Well, and I don't want to get to this. I don't want to jump ahead of us. But is this really a function of trade policy not functioning towards the goals that we have, or is it in fact actually functioning the way that trade policy is supposed to function based upon those people who are implementing it? In other words, you're talking about this trade policy is providing incentives for U.S. corporations to essentially offshore most of their production and undercutting wages. But it could also be perceived in some way as subsidizing the offshoring of these productions, which, of course, hugely benefits these corporations. In other words, it depends on, the perspective of whether or not these trade policies are not functioning the way that we want them, or that maybe it's not we, in this case, the majority of Americans, who really are setting the goals for trade policy.
Well, I think that's certainly clear, just in the simple measure of polls, people are skeptical of these policies and have been skeptical for a long time. But, the bottom line here is that trade policy and tax policy and so many of these other policies are being driven what's the basic medium of influence in America, and that is money. The influence of, especially since the end of the 1970s, the beginning of the 80s, the influence of big money, corporate money in American politics has been relentlessly growing. And with the Supreme Court decision of Citizens United in January 2010, the floodgates have been open. So it's not that trade policy, I think you're the way you put it is correct. It's not that trade policy is not working. The question is, who is it working for? And clearly it's working for people who basically make their money by investing in other places. You know, the difference between the situation today and the situation in most of our history is that there's always been tension between labor and capital, always conflicts, fighting over the surplus. But until recently, big business understood that in the end it needed the American public. It needed. Henry Ford put it well when he raised, and Henry Ford was a famous union buster. But when he raised wages to $5 a day back in the early part of the 20th century, his pals in Wall Street, said, "Henry, what are you doing paying these people this exorbitant sum?" And he said, "Well, I need them to make the cars, and I need them to buy the cars." And today, so the people at the top, financial top, the corporates, corporate leadership understood that their future was in the United States. Today, that's not so. I've got in my book a quote from the guy who's the CEO of Cisco Systems, huge IT corporation based on American technology, funded largely by the U.S. taxpayer. And a couple of years ago, he says to his own stockholders, my goal is to make this a Chinese company. Well, that makes sense from his point of view. You know, he's the head of a multinational corporation. But from the point of view of the future of the United States and the majority of people who work for a living, it makes no sense. Yet, when Cisco Systems, along with Microsoft and Apple and, you know, all the rest of them, walk into the senator's office or walk into the offices of the U.S. Treasury, they are welcomed as representing America's future. And people have to begin to understand that that is no longer the case.
So, which brings us back to one of the third reason, or that you mentioned as to why our wages have stagnated, and that is the rolling back of New Deal protections, and I guess the encouragement, or at least not the active discouragement of unionization, because. It seems to me that if we have one of the things that have always protected the future, essentially, of the American worker has been the fact that corporations and business needed the American worker to rise to create a market for them. If that check on unbridled corporate power is gone now, We have nothing. I mean, it seems that there's not much that can sort of slow that down. I mean, short of maybe some type of resurgence of unions, but of course, that seems unlikely at the very least because unions can't exist in a vacuum, right? I mean, we didn't have just unions simply because they were tolerated. There was also some measure of government providing, you know, their capacity to unionize in the same way that government creates the capacity for people to form a corporation.
That's right. And one of the flaws in our public arguments, the debates that we have in the public in the media, is that inequality, which everyone recognizes has been growing, is seen as something separate from political decision making. And in fact, common sense as well as our history tells us that as inequality gets worse in the economic sphere, it leads to more inequality in the political sphere. And so, you know, as the labor unions lost strength, while the Democratic Party, which should have been their champion, was sort of indifferent to their future over the last 30 years, and while the labor unions lost strength, that meant that the other side, capital, corporate money, corporate influence, gathered strength. So it's no surprise that the entire, you know, policymaking of the U.S. government has become more and more pro-multinational corporation and less pro-American worker.
Right. A plutocracy, I guess, follows a plutonomy.
That's exactly right.
And so when we hear, and there was so much emphasis about this, I was struck by President Clinton making this argument at the Democratic Convention, former President Clinton, obviously, that what we need to do is, I mean, he was making an argument that there are 3 million jobs out there that aren't filled because people don't have the skill sets here. Give me your take on that notion and the implications of that argument that somehow what we have is a structural misalignment between workers' skills and the jobs that are open. I mean, you've already mentioned the fact that we know going forward in the future that education is not going to be such a relevant factor for jobs because of the nature of the type of jobs. But what is the danger of that argument being put out there that somehow the answer is education?
Well, the danger is that we're going to be churning out more and more people with college educations without creating the jobs for those people. Now, since 2001, again, as you say, this is not just about the recession. Since 2001, the entry wage for college graduates, for male college graduates, has dropped 11%. 7% for female college graduates. Now, during this whole period before the crash, what you see is entry-level wages dropping for the college educated. Well, what does that mean? What does that tell us? That tells us that we're not creating enough jobs to employ the college educated. So we're churning out more and more of these kids. We have encouraged them to go into debt to get an education. They come out. There are very few jobs. The competition is fierce. Most of them don't get professional jobs. They're waiting on tables. They're driving cabs. They're cleaning houses. At best, they get a job at Apple. And look at what that job does. Go into an Apple store and you'll see the future. That is, you see bright, college-educated kids working as retail clerks to sell Chinese goods. So the simple mind, I'm a firm believer in education. That's not the point. But the simple-minded notion that, oh, no, we don't have to worry about, these kinds of forces that are going on in the world. Just get yourself a college education, I just think is completely irresponsible. Yes, employers are always complaining that they don't have enough skilled workers. What they want is, you know, a perfectly qualified person to work at the lowest minimum price. And to take, those kinds of complaints seriously is just irresponsible.
I mean, is it? I'm trying to divine the intent of people who promote this, and I imagine that there are some who genuinely believe that this is the issue. But the implications of this are that essentially that there is nothing structurally wrong here. And that, in some ways, it is a way of diverting the necessary agency onto the workers, as opposed to society and government in some respect.
Yeah, well, as opposed to the people at the top of the governing class, that's absolutely right. If you can respond to the complaints and the anxieties of the American public by saying, hey, get yourself a college education, can't afford it, Romney says, borrow the money from your mother. If that's the answer, then people like Mitt Romney and Bill Clinton are not responsible for this. It was Republicans and the top of the leadership of the Democratic Party who made all these deals, who, while the country's economy was becoming less and less competitive, exacerbated the problem. So it's a way of denying responsibility, and that's very ironic because all these people get up there and say, what America needs is more people to take responsibility. They should start with themselves.
And this is also, it seems to me, a mechanism in which to keep essentially people passive in regards to what they, in regards to the policies that are creating this dynamic.
Yeah, I think what they're doing is they're kicking the can down the road, because if, as what we see now continues to happen, and I think it will without serious and radical change, what we're going to have is more and more discontented people. And, who knows the future? But in a situation where you have people in debt, overeducated for the jobs that they have, you're going to raise discontent among a more and more volatile, ambitious, and a group that, they've been to college. They don't have to take this lying down. I think that they're setting themselves up for some real problems. Now, those problems may, what comes in the future may not solve it. Hard times, you can go to the right as well as go to the left.
Right. I think the number three most popular party now in Greece, for instance, is the neo-fascist party.
Yeah, well, we think, oh, no, that can't happen. That can't happen in America. Well, it's not going to happen exactly like Greece or exactly like some of these other countries. But we're sitting on a tinderbox. And if the path that we can project right now with, on our current path, no matter who gets elected president, if that continues, at some point it's gonna blow up.
Is there really any way of short-circuiting that future? In other words, I mean, you mentioned Citizens United being so problematic, but of course, Citizens United seems to be coming sort of after we got beyond, you know, what one could perceive as a tipping point. In other words, you know, we could go back to pre-Citizens right. United, but we would still be on the same trajectory as we were before.
Yeah, I think it's not a question of just changing the rule, changing the law, but it does seem to me that the tsunami of money that is now dominating politics, and anybody can observe it, offers an opportunity for a way of thinking about our future that starts with reality, and that is the question that we talked about before: who's benefiting from all this, and how does it work? And in my view, the central question is the question of right now is the question of money in politics. There's no, in my mind, and I think in the people have been writing books. Some of them have written myself over the last 20 years about what a high wage strategy in the new global competition might look like, and it involves more investment in public infrastructure and in education and in research development in a way that keeps the jobs in the United States, which means a change in trade policy. It involves re-diverting capital back into productive business in the United States, which means shutting down the avenues to irresponsible speculation on Wall Street. I mean, it means a health care policy that really gets the costs in this country down and covers everybody the way a number of countries, including Canada, to our north have done. So it's not like we don't know, at least collectively, that there are ways out of this. But the money and the plutocracy that is now developed is just strangling our ability to respond to the changes that have occurred over the last 30 years in America's position in the globe. And so we've got to deal with that. People say, oh, well, you can't do much about money in politics. Well, if you can't do anything about it, hold on to your hat, because we're going downhill over the next 10 or 15 years.
We're speaking, we're pre-taping this interview, and there's very good, I believe this is probably going to run on September 17th, which of course is the 1 year anniversary of the beginning of the Occupy movement, mm-hmm. in New York City in Zuccotti Park. And, just give me your sense of, it's unclear whether or not the Occupy movement could sort of regenerate as the Occupy movement or as something else. But give me your sense of the impact that you think that it had, and that a movement, if not this specific nominal movement, but a different one or with the same energy, the implications it could have.
Well, I think the way I look at the Occupy movement is that it's scaffolding. It's sort of it's scaffolding to the first floor to rebuild this this country. I think two things were going on. One is when the polls were taken on the issues that were raised by Occupy, turned out that majorities of Americans favored their position. On the other hand, when they turned on the television and they looked at the the occupation, they looked at the lifestyle that they assume was going on there. This was not the American middle class, and wasn't something that people could look at and say, "Oh yeah, these are the leaders of the future." So it had its obvious limitations, but I think that You know, over the next 6 weeks, everything is all political consciousness is involved around the election. But I think that the day after the election, there are now, you know, in the labor movement and in some of the other institutional sectors, I think there is now a sense that, for example, even if President Obama is reelected, the next 4 years, without a change in the fundamental politics and attitudes in this country, are not going to be any different than the last 4 years. My own view is that if Romney got elected, they'd be worse than the last 4 years. But in terms of, you know, the standard of living of the average American, it might go down faster under Romney, slower under Obama, but the direction is still down unless we deal with some of these fundamental political obstacles.
And let me just, I mean, in closing, just this may be slightly off topic, but that's sort of the part that interests me, is that where does poverty fit into this? Because we're talking about the median or the so-called middle class, and it's sort of like slow decline. And where does poverty work into this? Because it seems to me that at the very least, we still hear some, you know, I guess Romney famously said, you know, I'm not worried about the poor. They're fine. They're fine.
Right.
As if, you know, and then, of course, we start to then later in the campaign, they were exploiting the notion that President Obama had pulled back on the work for welfare program. And then, sadly, President Obama had to come out, and the truth was that he wasn't, but the truth was that he had to sort of espouse the brilliance of the work for welfare program, when in fact most people who are aware of this, of what's happening with the poor, realize that this has been a tragedy, because whether it's you have a single mother who's not unable to, right, to care for their children. I mean, so give me your sense of where poverty fits into this, both from a political and policy stance.
Well, I think that from an economic point of view, obviously the people at the bottom are having it worse, not only in terms of cutbacks in assistance, but in opportunities. I mean, when you've got a situation in which the middle class is their opportunities are declining, then you're going to get people with more education, high school, 2 years of college education, vying for jobs that were just up the ladder for the poor. So the situation, you know, down below, as it were, clearly is going to get worse. Secondly, in terms of the political feelings of altruism and compassion, the truth is that compassion is easier to afford, and the middle class is more supportive of those kinds of things in good times. When times turn hard, people are saying, "Why should I pay taxes, you know, for somebody else to get Medicare, Medicaid, when you know, I can't afford it for my 26-year-old kids?" So I think that you have this bifurcation. I'm struck that there've been a bunch of books and reports about poverty rising in America. But it doesn't seem to be connected to what's going on in the vast majority of the middle class. And as they were saying at the Democratic convention, they say every 4 years, we're all in this together. Well, more and more, as the structural problems get worse and the foundations of the economy deteriorate, the middle class and the poor are going to be in this together.
Interesting. Well, Jeff Foe, F-A-U-X, the French spelling, I guess. Yep. Distinguished Fellow, Economic Policy Institute, I believe the founder as well. And author of The Servant Economy. Thanks so much for joining us. We'll put a link up to The Servant Economy at our site at majority.fm. A real pleasure speaking to you today.
Thank you, Sam. Great to be with you.
It's Sam Cedar launching an illegal invasion and occupation of your brain.
Welcome to the literal, not metaphorical, Wall Street.
Yeah. It is Monday, September 17th, 2012. This is The Majority Report with Sam Cedar. However, I am Matt Binder, producer of The Majority Report, and I am here in the streets at Broadway and Wall Street with my fellow producer, Michael Brooks.
How's everybody doing? We're here. We're close by to Hipster Cop, who is looking very snazzy today as he holds the line against people doing civil disobedience, and we're reporting live.
Michael is enamored by Hipster Cop.
I'm impressed.
Basically, what we did here is me and Michael, we got down here at 7 a.m., where at 7 o'clock, protesters met at four different locations throughout Lower Manhattan. We went to the location right across the street from Zuccotti Park, which I believe was called the 99% zone. They zoned to different areas. And at 7 o'clock across Zuccotti Park was closed off by police, riot cops everywhere, easily outnumbering the protesters. But there was a good amount, I would say maybe 200, 300 protesters at the Red Cube, and they were going over today's action. And around 7:30, 7:45 a.m., the march began, led by Bishop Packard, who you all might remember as the same bishop from that, I believe, the Episcopalian Church, who on December 17th of last year was the first to climb over the fence into Trinity's property, and he was promptly arrested, and he's become sort of a well-known Occupy figure.
He was promptly arrested this morning as well.
Yes, he was arrested.
He
yes.
led the disobedience.
He led the march.
He led the march. People sat on the sidewalk right in front of TD Bank.
Right at...
What address is this?
Right at Broadway and Wall Street.
Right at Broadway and Wall Street.
I don't believe TD Bank had any significance. I mean, I know it's a bank, but the reason they stopped at Broadway and Wall Street is that there are... you cannot get into you can't get into the stock area.
You can't.
The New York Stock Exchange area. You just can't get into Wall Street. You can't. It is completely barricaded off in every direction. Right where we are, there is a line of police on horses. And right now we're sort of just kind of watching as the bus carrying the first group of arrestees, which included Bishop Packard, drove off. And now it's kind of everyone's kind of at a standstill here.
There's definitely more police than protesters. The protesters came with their usual, they're pretty calm, pretty relaxed. They seem to be well-trained in what they were doing. And the cops, you know, they sort of responded as you'd expect them to. There seems to be a lot more tension amongst people trying to control the protest than amongst the protesters themselves. But we'll see if more people show up. There was definitely not a very significant turnout, and now we have another wave of people coming, which we're going to move towards and check out.
We're currently staring at a line of police officers. Has to be, what is this? About 50 police officers, I would say, maybe more. And this is just on one corner, literally on one corner. I don't mean dispersed throughout. I mean, on one corner, on one side of the
street, there's probably 50.
There is 50 police officers.
What flags are these people waving that are coming this way? I don't recognize those flags. Do you know?
They look like it might be Veterans for Peace. That's what I'm.
I believe Veterans for Peace flag.
I see doves on this flag. On the flag. This is the second march we've seen come down. The second wave of protesters coming down.
Second wave of protesters. I don't know if this wave is planning on participating in civil disobedience. But it looks like they very well may be.
Well, let's walk down there. We are heading towards the crossroads.
We got to keep to the side. Some Mardi Gras thing going on, some like Cajun music, which you can probably hear.
We are now in the march. We have some technical difficulties here. Let me be the first to say that if you've been following the Majority Report's coverage of Occupy Wall Street, this is much different than any other on the ground we've been to so far. Usually, when we're covering the Occupy events of the day, when our show runs, it's basically the protesters around 10, 11 a.m. getting together, and they're getting ready for the day's actions. Today, the action started early. We started at 7 a.m. and we're here right now. I believe it's 8:15, maybe 8:30. You got the time there?
It's 8:22. You're in the zone.
8:22. So we're within the first, 20 minutes of our recording here. My mic has already been pulled out by the ensuing...
Your mic has already been pulled out. A bunch of people have already been arrested. It's been a very eventful hour and a half.
It has been a very eventful hour and a half. That is very true.
And we just saw something funny happen. We saw a marcher, a middle-aged looking gentleman with a tie on, in fact, walking by chanting, saying, "You're not going to steal our pensions today." And an NYPD officer thought that was pretty funny, which was kind of amusing because probably the guy was talking about the NYPD guy's pension as well.
Funny, he found it funny enough to repeat exactly.
To repeat it to his colleague standing next to him.
While laughing.
While laughing. Apparently, some NYPD dudes think that pension theft is potentially funny.
We just hit...
The guy did deliver it in a funny way, though, to be fair to the cop. It was a pretty...
We just hit Broadway and New York Stock Exchange. It is completely blocked off, like the block before it. Like the intersection before it. Right now we are following the second wave of marchers. They are doing something different than the first wave. The first wave stopped at Broadway and Wall Street and would not move, and that is when Bishop Packard and maybe 10 others were arrested. This march proceeded right past that intersection, so I believe they're headed to another spot where another action will take place. I believe
that this group, from what I could see in the morning's meetup, they were also training and planning on getting arrested as well. So presumably, they're just moving to another spot to practice civil disobedience and get arrested. We also heard a rumor, which seemed credible earlier today, that there was 18 police vans ready by the water for arrests throughout the day.
Yes, I heard that. Right now we're at, I'm just trying to pay attention to where we are right now.
I can't see it yet.
To my left is the march, and to my right is a line of police officers, probably just as long as the march.
We're on Morris and Broadway. Was it Morris and Broadway?
That's what it looks like, yes.
Oh, and we're right by the bull. We're right by the bull, yo.
As always, the most important part of this area, more important than any one person or one place, is of course the statue of the Wall Street Bull.
The statue of the Wall Street Bull.
And of course,
right,
we cannot forget how important it is to block that off with, I believe, how many police officers are surrounding it?
Actually, less than I would think. It only looks about 8 or 9, actually.
The fact that 8 or 9 police officers surrounding a statue is less than we think, as sad as it is.
Yeah.
As sad as could be.
That's a fair point. This is an interesting kind of Mardi Gras theme to today's protest.
The first march was led by, I believe, it was the, I'm not sure what the official name of the group is, but Occupy Faith, I believe. It's the group with the, excuse me. It's the group that has, you know, priests and rabbis and other religious figures from different churches in the area, different religious institutions in the area that support Occupy movement. And that was a very silent march that started with Bishop Packard leading the group. And this march is led by a marching band.
This group, yeah, this is the sort of celebratory group happening this time. And now we're coming to, where are we now? Was that Market Fields and what? I don't know. And Code Pink is here.
Yeah, Code Pink just met up with
Pink
them at the
club. And this is like a real band. Like, listen to this. This is nice. What are they saying? I wish you could hear what they're chanting.
Must stop the banks.
Bust up the banks. Well, same message, essentially. Alright, so that's the second wave. I don't know. You think there'll be a third wave?
Let's keep going. The march stopped at, I believe it was two Broadway, where they stopped in front of an office. We could not find out who it was because it was just so loud and the cops dispersed them so quickly. The march continued on, and we are now at, where are we, Michael?
Beaver and Broad.
We're at Beaver and Broad, where basically it looks like two different marches on two separate sides seem to have combined, I think it looks like.
It looks like people are trying to congregate, but it's really chaotic here. And did we say that there's been a report of, I think, 25 arrests so far?
There's been, yes. NLG has confirmed that it's 8:40?
8:40. There's already been 25 arrests. We actually heard that about 15 minutes ago. So they're already
including a legal observer. A legal observer was arrested as well.
I'm on the edge of arrest.
Same parallel is running with marchers on the sidewalk, police forming lines on the street, and also congregating in front of banks, offices, and front and buildings.
You know, oddly enough, I have to say, this is very reminiscent of actually exactly 1 year ago on September 17th when, when they first got down, when Occupy Wall Street first began, the call was made to get down on Wall Street that Sunday last year. There was no plan to go to Zuccotti Park at first, if you remember correctly. The plan was to encamp on Wall Street, and the police stopped that right away. There was never a tent pitched on Wall Street, obviously. But the protesters who went down that first day basically marched down these same streets, sort of trying to figure out what to do and where to make the actions happen. And it looks like this is what's going on. I think
it's following the same
point
pattern.
Basically today is to just basically make this area as difficult to get through as possible.
Yeah, the point is to remind everybody that there's still a presence, that these issues are still front and center. And I think there's no question that without Occupy Wall Street, you probably wouldn't see the type of some of the discussion that's happened in the presidential race, some of the shift in tone at least. Obviously, people out here today want a lot more than a shift in tone, and they want to come out and remind Wall Street and remind the broader political community that people still care about the issues that they're highlighting.
That was incredibly well spoken for someone in the middle of this intense march with police surrounding the protesters. That was very well done.
Thanks, man. I do my doing what I can do on very little sleep, actually. I had to get up at 4:30 in the morning to get here.
I feel that completely.
Yeah. What time? Yeah, because you're coming from... We came in from the outer boroughs for this.
At Broadway, and... Listen, it is so hard to tell what is going on right now, to be honest.
It seems like nobody knows what's going on. You know, it's very, it doesn't seem that well planned, sort of, from any direction. And then there's sort of significant congregations at certain points, but I'm not really quite sure what the overall plan or structure to this is. There's also, I think, reminiscent of the first year, there's people taking time to just sort of celebrate and dance. There's a festive feel, and the musicians are back. And this also looks, again, like another potential flashpoint here. But we don't know.
They got that knocked down. So essentially, they're trying to, like,
if we go on the sidewalk, I don't know, like, we can...
Basically, there's a sort of circular thing happening here because the... It's very unclear, though. And now their marchers are being told to move again and not blocking the sidewalk.
I believe we're at the corner of Broadway and Beaver, and basically what happened is protesters stop at the corner, and we had police on the other corner blocking them and stopping them from walking any further down Broadway. And
there's
basically
also
police are successfully pushing them towards where they want them to go.
There's also a crowd on Bowling Green as well, so it looks like people are just stopping at different corners, and that's sort of where the action's taking place. But the police are definitely pushing them and moving them pretty strongly where they want to go.
Damien!
And my sense is that this might be a possible flashpoint here as well.
I'm just running to Allison Kilkenny here from Citizen Radio and The Nation. How are you doing, Allison?
I'm well. How are you?
I'm very good. What are the odds of us running into each other here?
One in 1,000? How many people are out here, do you think? I don't know.
I honestly can't tell. Where were you in the morning?
So I was down on Water Street. There were around 200 people there. I saw reports that there were a similar number at Zuccotti. And, I think it's got to be just, like, around 1,000 people, I would say.
I would guess around 1,000. We started today at across from Zuccotti. And I think the numbers, from what I saw picture-wise, I think it was more at Waters, actually.
Yeah, that seemed like the largest faction. But I think combined, because there's like 4 or 5 spots where it started. A crazy number of police as well. So it's been an exciting morning. It's definitely one of the largest turnouts since last year.
I would agree. Did you, when the march left from Waters, what was the first spot? Did you follow that march, and what was the first spot that they went across?
Oh, we've been all over the place. I couldn't even tell you. We've just been up and down so many streets in the financial district. I saw 4 or 5 arrests. One was a journalist named Julia. She's a photographer. The police are being really super aggressive. The white shirts particularly are shoving protesters. The police officers on mopeds are accelerating very rapidly and almost running into protesters. It's business as usual. We're used to it in New York, but it makes me nostalgic for last year because it feels like that.
Yeah, I actually, we went by and someone said something, someone screamed out something like, you won't be stealing our pensions today, and there was just laughter from the police. They just were just not, they're very different from last year around this time when it was a different atmosphere between the police and the protesters, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously not a monolith, and there are police officers who, like, understand that Occupy Wall Street is fighting for them, too, but they're also getting overtime to babysit protesters, essentially, and occasionally beat them up. So I think, you know, that's the big debate. When are the cops going to join the 99% movement? Obviously, we're not there yet.
Unfortunately, I honestly don't think that would happen. That's going to happen. Yeah.
I said that too, and somebody reminded me that they said that in Greece as well, that the police wouldn't join, but then they did. But things have to get really bad for that to happen. And I think as long as they're making good money, violating the rights of citizens, then it'll keep going.
Yeah. I mean, maybe I could see that happening in another city or town or area, but I in New York, I don't think.
Well, yeah. Actually, that's a good point. You know, you do hear stories about, like, small town sheriffs refusing to kick people out of their homes. Maybe it's a matter of, like, being close to the people that you're policing. And in New York City, I mean, police officers, we're not a small town, you know? So maybe that's the problem. There's just too much distance between the protesters and the police.
So what do you think about the overall idea of, because we were talking to Jeff Smith last week, and he thought that, you know, celebrating the anniversary of Occupy Wall Street is sort of, it's too self-referential.
Yeah. Well, there's also something about putting a revolutionary date on a calendar and saying this is your day where you can be, like, protesters. That's sort of what happened to the labor movement. Like, labor got a day.
Yeah.
And it's like, here's the day you can protest, then go home. So I think it is dangerous to have, like, an anniversary date. But I do also think that Occupy needed a reminder that they can be powerful if they turn out in large numbers. And it's been neat seeing protesters reconnect with each other. Some of them haven't seen each other in, like, a year, you know? So I think it's important to sort of bolster that sense of community. But I do understand the critiques that say making September 17th the Occupy Day. Every day should be Occupy Day. So, yeah.
Thank you, Allison. This is Allison Kilkenny with Citizen Radio and The Nation. It's wearecitizenradio.com, right?
Correct.
All right, awesome. I was mentioning how this is probably, you know, people like to joke about how, you know, disorganized Occupy Wall Street is, but I mean, I've been on the ground, and today is actually the first day that I can actually say that it seems kind of disorganized, but I'm here with Allison Kilkenny, and she has a different perspective on things.
Yeah, so this action is essentially what they did November 17th, which is they usually have a centralized action. In this case, it was called the People's Wall, where people volunteered to maybe get arrested down on Wall Street. They linked arms, tried to block intersections. But then pinwheeling out from that centralized action are smaller actions. So we're marching with one right now. And the idea behind that was to sort of break up the police and have smaller sort of occupations at intersections and create havoc and shut down the financial district. So it's, in my opinion, it's a smart strategy. It's very clever.
You're not going to get through. You got to... Easy does it. That was funny, though. She's just like, I'm coming.
It's a effective way to shut down the financial district with not that many people. I mean, there's a good turnout today, maybe around 1,000 people, but there's always an enormous amount of police who come out. So by splitting up, that also splits up the police, and they end up having to chase protesters for miles and miles around the financial district. So, I mean, it is a clever way to be an effective protest movement with very little resources.
So would you say, because I actually haven't seen other than, actually at Broadway and Wall, we saw sit-in with Bishop Packard,
yes,
and he was arrested.
Yes.
And, but other than that, I haven't seen the plans, you know, there was supposed to be the big sit-in action.
Yeah, they were supposed to. I'm not down on Water Street. I was thinking about heading over there, but I heard that they just left there. But I'm checking Twitter, and it seems like there are actions going on right now. Of course, it's never like an exact plan. Like people break off and do their own thing. But Occupy's always been about like sort of facilitating that, where it's like if you want to do your own thing, go do your own thing. The People's Wall was sort of meant to be a peaceful direct action. People volunteered to get arrested. But they also wanted that leeway where it's like, well, what if we want to do something slightly more radical? Do we have that option? And that was the idea behind, like, if you break off, you can do your own thing.
That's really interesting.
Yeah, it's always been this balance between, like, the sort of old school reformers who are like, we do everything peacefully and, like, the Gandhi approach. But then there are the anarchists, too, who say, like, well, what if we want to use tactics that you don't think are acceptable? Can we have that option as well? And Occupy's always struggled with allowing that because the possibility of, like, property damage makes, I think, some of the moderates, like, crazy, you know? They don't want to facilitate that. But Occupy's about being inclusive, too. So I know in the planning for this, they really, really stressed, we are non-threatening, we are peaceful, please don't throw a brick through a window or anything like that, you know? And I haven't seen anything like that on this
Nothing
march.
Like that. In fact, I've seen many protesters thank the police being out here today.
So
it's a very friendly,
like,
very calm attitude, mostly.
That was a criticism as well, that it's like, it's too
not,
friendly.
Not confrontational
it's
enough.
It's not threatening anymore. And last year it was legitimately threatening. I mean, like, they shut down the Brooklyn Bridge. There was a real fear on Wall Street that, like, is this it? Is this, like, the mass popular movement that's going to finally, you know, come back to bite us in the ass? And I don't think they're worried about that anymore.
No, you can kind of see the condescension and the dismissal on the faces of a lot of the folks walking by. And actually, to be honest, I feel a fair amount of just curiosity.
Yeah.
There's been a lot of genuine, because it's a different happening, and you also never know, you know,
there was
what people's
moment.
More private attitudes are like.
Yeah, there was a great moment last year, though, where I was following a faction that broke off from an Occupy march, and they went to Goldman Sachs, and Goldman was just getting out for the day. And these employees were leaving Goldman Sachs, and they ran into the Occupy protesters who were, like, fired up. And these Goldman employees, like, you could see that they were, like, legitimately afraid. They were like, are they going to just storm the building? Like, where are the cops? And but that is gone now. That is, like, they get it now. They're like, okay, they'll march around for an hour, and that'll be the end of it. But that's not to say it won't become radical again. I mean, anything can set it off. Nobody could have predicted last year this would have started, you know?
Yeah. I always find it funny when, you know, whenever there's a big Occupy action now, there's always, you know, in the Huffington Post or, you know, Daily News, New York Post, anywhere like that, you know, can Occupy successfully come back? Is this their big comeback? I mean,
this is definitely not threatening. Just echoing the point. Yeah.
Confetti is being thrown.
Confetti is being thrown. What's amazing is they throw confetti on presidential candidates in Bolivia. And somebody said that was like the only way that the peasant classes could sort of say F you to political candidates.
We're now standing here, marching along what's your name?
Kanae Holder.
And you're with Occupy Wall Street.
Oh, definitely. I've been here since week two of Occupy Wall Street in the PR working group. We're talking to the press about the reasons why we occupy. Also POC, People of Color Working Group, and also Direct Action.
That's great. What time did you get down here today?
Oh, goodness. I've been down here since like 7 o'clock in the morning talking to the press.
Down here today so far?
Oh, it's been amazing. It's been an amazing show of faith over fear. People are here. They're not afraid of the cops. They're not afraid of getting arrested. They are here to showcase the right to free speech. So they're not fearful of it. Even though they're free speech zones and the cops keep arresting people for arbitrary and absolutely no reason whatsoever,
happens.
I was walking along talking with
We're watching Syria and the government that is the people. The pain is this.
No justice, no peace, no justice, no peace, no justice, no peace.
Again, who does our government protect? Who does our government serve? So right now, as these corporations, including Citibank, Wells Fargo, Bank of America, as they continue to find new ways to rip people off and take away their right to say, being able to save their money and put food on their table, as these banks continue to do that right now as we speak, are they being arrested? Who's being arrested? They're killing the messenger. We are here to speak truth. We are here to bring light to the corruption that is rampant. We can no longer trust these institutions.
I think that's what, I mean, it's kind of difficult to talk over everything what's going on right here, but I mean, I think that's the thing that, you know, mainstream media and, you know, people in general, and people in general don't really seem to get when reporting on Occupy. They ask, oh, what has Occupy done? What is Occupy doing? And I think what you just said, how, you know, the police are here to shoot the messenger. I mean, I think that is Occupy's role. People expect that Occupy will be the change. I think Occupy's role here is to bring the message of what's going on. And it's, and I mean, from protesters are now chanting at the police that they are the ones blocking pedestrian traffic.
That was the you are blocking pedestrian traffic, bro moment. I thought they arrested somebody specifically. Got some good window viewing going on.
Oh yeah, there.
Yeah, you got some.
There's people all along.
Oh, look at that! I think by now we're up to at least 40 arrests. That's been there
for a while, yeah.
I didn't see that.
We're in front of the Amalgamated Bank, and they have the sign up that says Amalgamated Bank supports the UFT and the Occupy Wall Street movement.
And I definitely need to set up an Amalgamated account.
I'm sure a lot of people have, yes. I actually think, I'm not sure if I'm 100% correct on this, but I think Ben and Jerry switched over to Amalgamated Bank.
Well, the DNC actually switched to the Amalgamated Bank, the Democratic National Committee.
$10 million were pulled out of corporate banks and moved into credit unions.
Yes, yes, yes. The bank transfer day, I think it was called, yes.
Yeah, it's been continuing.
It's continuous, yes.
No. So, do you need anything else?
That was great, thank you. What's your name again?
Kanae Holder.
And you're with the Occupy Wall Street PR team?
Most definitely, yes.
Thank you very much.
Sure.
All right, so we're talking with a self-identified one percenter who's here in solidarity with the Occupy Wall Street Anniversary March. And why don't you just tell us about your background and why you're here?
Sure. Well, I was born and bred on the Upper East Side. Always felt uncomfortable. And that it was my duty to help change the world the way it was, because I saw it from the inside, grew up with the people who have made it the way that it is, and never seemed to ever agree with much of what was said in my house or in my private school or my boarding school or anything like that. And so I became a clinical psychologist and a social activist. And I'm down here today just to prove that, first, that the 1% is not all adversarial to the 99%.
Of course, yeah.
And also that because we're running out of time in terms of the environment, in terms of the social storm that's brewing, The 1% is the cause of the problem, but the best viable solution to the problem, too.
So that's interesting perspective, and I want to ask you, what do you see as the connection between your psychotherapy work and activism?
Well, part of my brand of clinical psychology is that human health has to integrate social activism,
right,
community compassion. If you're not working, if you're just working for yourself and even your own mental health, that's only part of it. You must be, to be a healthy human being, you must be working for everyone's happiness, everyone's health. And so that's how I encourage and help support people to an idea of mental health that includes everyone.
Do you think that there's an emotional and psychological health component to the situation we find ourselves in?
I'm not quite sure what you mean.
In terms of, like, do you think that part of what's happening in Wall Street is collectivized forms of selfishness? There's fear. We're living in separate ways.
Yeah. Well, I was brought up to not only fear everyone who wasn't from the Upper East Side, but also fear losing my money. Fear losing all of these privileges and all these things that were supposed to make me happy. And that, you know, my ancestors worked so hard to give me, and all of that kind of brainwashing, pretty much. So I think, you know, I have compassion for the people that I grew up with. They are very damaged human beings. We're all damaged in different ways. But the people with the power, their damage damages so many other people that I would rather have compassion for them, but have them nowhere near the controls of politics or society.
Cool. So, makes sense.
One interesting thing you mentioned, you said that you feel like the 1% is the solution to the problem. But I think there's an argument that, the 1% and people who have money tend to hold on to that money and not spend it like the middle class who drives the economy.
You're right. And typically that is true. But I'm right here to tell you there's at least one person that does not do that. And if there's one, there's a lot. Now, frankly, I haven't met a lot, and it's my mission or my job to help people who have the money and the power do what they, I think, in their hearts know is the right thing, but they don't have the strength, or they fear being ostracized, like me, from their own class. So I will agree with you that that's typical, but it doesn't have to be this way.
What would you say the consensus is for, you know, the people from your class that you hang out, that you socialize with? What they feel about Occupy? The general consensus that they don't like it, or they do like it and are afraid to join in?
Because I don't really socialize with my class, the ones that I do think it's basically they just think it's a nuisance. It's so far above, in a sense, being even angry or emotionally involved. They're so distanced from the problems of the 99% and most people that it's almost like it's an irritation that they wish would go away. But I do also have a lot of friends who verbally agree with everything, but they're not here today. They don't get out. And I myself am trying to get out more. And this, I've been chasing down every microphone I can find today because it feels like that's what I can offer, as well as my body, you know, to this. And I was part of the People's Wall and all that. But I decided not to get arrested because I wanted to do this. So, you know, I would say there's in the same way is that there are sleeping occupiers, and also that's just one dimension of what needs to be happening. Occupy, there's the environment, there's all sorts of things. There are lots of sleepers out there in all classes, and people just need to try to wake up, as well as be supported in what little they can do, even if it's just recycling, you know. But people need to be encouraged to do more because we are running out of time. That time is short. If all of us live to be really old men, the world is going to be absolutely different. It's absolutely unavoidable. But it could be less different, or not different, but worse. It could be better. By the time we die, if we are healthy and eat well, 80, 90 or something, we could really turn
turn something
around
here.
Yeah.
We've still got 50, 60 years of environmental pollution to live through. But we could die knowing that the slide into the toilet has been slowed and possibly going back downhill.
I think that's a really good point to make, because a lot of people don't realize, you know, when you hear coverage about Occupy, it's been 1 year, what have they done? A lot of people don't realize these movements take time. 1 year is baby steps.
I'm trying to shift the context. That's the whole point.
And also shift the whatever you call it, the paradigm or consciousness. For somebody, I mean, if you ask yourself, how hard is it to change your behavior for something you've done your whole life, you're just becoming aware of, maybe, you know, even if it's quitting smoking, you know, or doing something you know is good for you, how difficult some of these things are. We're talking about the whole species doing this. So it will take a while, but it needs to happen consistently all the time.
Thank you very much. What's your name again?
Welcome. Alexander Bingham.
Thank you very much, Alexander. Nice to meet you.
Alexander. Appreciate it.
Sure. All right.
Thank you.
Take care, man.
Sure. Okay, so first there was this big cop, and they started pushing people and shoving people. They shoved this guy and his girlfriend, and they pulled the girl by her hair down the sidewalk. And then...
she was on the ground, and they dragged her?
She was like half on the ground, half not on the ground. And then we were like all walking back, and they rushed at us, and a bunch of people ran, somebody tripped and fell, and then they arrested the guy who tripped and fell against the wall.
Okay.
And they were like swinging, they were swinging.
They were using batons?
I don't know if they were using batons, but I saw punches.
Yeah, we're good too. The cops are now moving.
We are at Morris and Broadway right now, where seems like a slew of arrests just went down. And I've happened to run into our Occupy Wall Street guy, Jeff Smith, a.k.a. Don't Be a Putz, now Jeff5Myth on Twitter. Jeff, how you doing?
Hi, good.
That's funny.
It's great to be back out here. Feels sort of like it's incredible that a year's gone by.
It's been a year. It is pretty insane. So what time did you get out here and what have you seen so far?
I was here just shortly after 11 or after 7 this morning when the congregation started happening at the different checkpoints. So I was across from Zuccotti, where a lot of people were, and it still has a feeling of a sort of reunion for a lot of people. Seeing a lot of people that took the summer off or have been doing other things, it feels a lot like old times, that sort of thing. It feels like having a reunion but doing it in public and making it, you know.
So what have you seen so far today in terms of any actions, marches, cops overstepping their bounds as usual?
It's been a lot, you know, it was a very decentralized protest, so there were a number of different areas, some focused on debt in particular. There was another area where it was more about the environment and eco issues, and others were more around just... you know, what they called the 99% zone, but it was really just a way to kind of decentralize it because the cops basically force us to not congregate in one large area anymore. And since the morning, it's really been a somewhat of an ad hoc plan. You have to respond in real time to what the cops let you do. And at some point, it started, the tempers tend to flare, and that's when the cops start, you know, grabbing people off the sidewalks, and it gets a little hectic, and then it calms back down again, and then people hang out. But in the meantime, I think it's just letting the city know that we're back again, and you know, the protests are going to be out on the streets again, and, you know, so in some ways I see this as just the beginning for what will come in the next couple of months, and see it sort of ramp back up. Not necessarily this is the day that everything's supposed to go down. I think it's just... But it's a nice celebration, and, you know, I think a lot of people that were cynical, myself included, about this, are happy to see as many people out here. It's been a nice solid showing, a nice solid crowd.
I was just about to ask you that. How many people would you say is here? Is this what, you know, people who organized the different actions today, is this the amount of people they were expecting? Is this below, above?
I think it's about. I mean, I think there have been upwards of, you know, 500 people in... numerous locations, so we're probably over 1,000 people total, and I think it is. I mean, it's certainly not as big as it once was, but
last September 17th, frankly, it wasn't as big as this. So from just the baseline starting point for this year, I would say this is, you know, quite a bit bigger, and people know what they're doing. That's really the main difference I see, is that there's a lot more experienced people out here now, because we've been through this and had so much practice at it that it's, you know, the numbers are smaller, but people definitely know what they're doing.
Yeah, I was saying earlier how it was, this feels very, very much like exactly 1 year ago on September 17th, when there was no exact, you know, location like Zuccotti at that moment, where people expected to, you know, stop and camp on Wall Street, and that didn't happen, obviously, so it was just a march around. And then I ran to Allison Kilkenny, who said, this feels very much like N17. What do you feel about in terms of actions, where today lies so far?
Yeah, I think that, you know, N17 is an obvious reference point because the attempt was very similar as far as doing an action down on Wall Street and trying to congregate. And actually, given what happened last fall, because as a response to the cops blocking off the different avenues we were going, we ended up doing a decentralized protest in different intersections throughout lower Manhattan. So I think in some ways, that almost created the plan for what we're going to do this time. So definitely smaller, but better organized this time. And I think it's good. It's been interesting to see the reaction from the Wall Street folks, because, you know, if you know the way Manhattan is, really, there's not really many people down here except the people that work here. It's not like you go through lower Manhattan on your way somewhere else normally. So it's an opportunity to kind of reemerge for that group of people, and hopefully the rest of the public will start to take notice again. I mean, that's what anniversaries are for in some ways, is to make people pay attention again. So I think we've taken advantage of that. And I mean, I'm hoping that the arrests are not the only story, but definitely the cops have been pretty vicious. You know,
I just wanted to ask you about that. What do you feel about how the cops are treating today? Because I do feel like, you know, a year ago, you know, the cop reaction was a lot different at that point, because, you know, Occupy Wall Street was just starting. A lot of people were talking about it at that point. You know, can the cops join the 99%? And there was a lot of stories of, you know, sympathetic cops, you know, socializing with the occupiers. And then as time went on, especially after Zuccotti was cleared out, that completely changed. And I feel like today might be the biggest action since. And it's interesting to see the cops, at least in my opinion, even though time has went by since there's been such a big action, it's almost like they're just as angry at these protesters as they were when they were at their height, you know, in October, November.
I would tend to agree, but I think, you know, not to make an untoward comparison, I think it's similar to, you know, our military forces that have been occupying and doing a job that they almost don't even know what it's for anymore. And so you get periods where I think you take out your aggression, and there's some people that are just frustrated that they have to do this duty, and they see an opportunity to bash a kid's head in and they take it. And those are probably the exceptions, but, you know, the feeling of being in lower Manhattan when one of these protests is going on really does feel like you're, you know, in an occupied country, to feel like the police forces, you know, marshaling you and telling you where you can go, and there's checkpoints. It really is kind of crazy. And so when you see the violence break out, or finally some of the cops just, you know, grab someone and start beating them as they arrest it, you feel like it's almost a recipe for that happening by putting this scenario together. And if the mayor and the police really were here to serve the public and keep everyone safe, it would look nothing like this, you know.
I mean, I find it amazing how we're, I mean, occupied during, you know, when it was at its height, it changed the conversation then. And I feel like today, you know, we've just been in the midst of, you know, election news 24/7 on all the news media channels and different outlets. And it's interesting to see. I mean, I'm down here. We're seeing and taking part in a political action, and there's absolutely no mention of electoral politics still. Well, I just find that to be amazing how, you know, last year they changed that conversation. I mean, I'm down here, I'm not hearing any conversation about what's currently being talked about, you know, what's currently the public perception.
Sure, but I think that, you know, Occupy Wall Street has really always been extremely issue-oriented.
Yes,
and
yes.
So the fact that our electoral politics are almost devoid of any real policy discussions, yes, anymore, I think nobody's interested. And that's why I think when the Chicago teacher strike happened, it was an opportunity to talk about something specific that Democrats and Republicans, frankly, aren't interested in talking about.
Yes.
And so that, I think, is what energizes people. So, you know, still coming down here and ranting about Wall Street and getting in bankers' faces, that's still, you know, the reason that we're down here right now. And I think that energizes people when the you know, sort of inane horse race stuff happens. It's almost like it's designed to make you uninterested. And it works.
And how do you feel about Occupy going forward now? I mean, every single outlet today is probably going to have some story about Occupy's reunion, did it work, or it's Occupy's comeback, are they here to stay? I mean, on the Majority Report, we've constantly been covering Occupy, and I would say our listeners know that Occupy, even if it's not a big, you know, event like an N17 or an S17, you know, occupiers themselves at least have been involved in all sorts of different actions, different debates in terms of all sorts of different things. Where do you see Occupy going forward as a whole from here?
Well, I mean, I think that in some ways, really, what's emerged after a year is just almost like a brand Occupy. And because we're not a group that's looking to trademark anything or profit off of anything, we don't really care who uses Occupy. So I think that there's a lot of grassroots organizing that has frankly been unable to get any public support, and you know, they've been chronically ignored. And now they can sort of put Occupy on the mantle and people start to pay attention. And if that's what it takes, you know, I'm definitely happy to see that happen. But when you see Occupy Bushwick and Occupy the Bronx and that kind of stuff, they're really more local issues. They've just taken on the mantle, and if that creates the media spotlight for them, I'm all for that. But I think it's just the emergence of a protest left that has just been absent in this country for a really long time, and that's why a lot of these old school organizers see this as like a new hope. But at the same time, for kids, it's like an education. And particularly since the actual school system we have now doesn't give much of a civic education to kids, I think this is sort of like guerrilla training, both in terms of the issues and becoming political, and also for a lot of young kids becoming journalists and telling the stories. And so when people listen to podcasts and, you know, read Twitter, that's a whole different media environment as well. And I think that's what Occupy has given birth to also.
It really is interesting to see reactions of not just, I mean, of course, it's fun to see the reactions of younger people. But I mean, just people who just forgot what it was like to see a protest. People of all ages. I mean, older people who've seen this before, but it's been just gone for such a long time. And I think it's very interesting to see. And just last week we had you on and you were talking about how you're looking forward to actually after the elections, you know, when there's seeing where Occupy goes from there, and also Occupy Wall Street, specifically in New York, how when Bloomberg's gone, how do you feel after seeing today and your feelings going forward from that? You still feel like, you know, I mean, I know it's only been a week, but I feel like I wasn't expecting today to be like how it was so far, and I'm very happy to see it like it is today.
Yeah, I think that it's, as I said, I think there were a lot of people that were cynical, and then once it started to happen and people came together, they definitely started to, you know, have a new sort of opinion and a fresh start in a sense. You know, one of the things I think that is hardest to convey via the media, whether it's print or even video, is sort of what it feels like to be at some of these events and to have people congregate like this. It really is sort of empowering. And so I think some of that feeling is starting to come back. And hopefully, you know, it's really about participation. And the more people come out, that's really when the powers start getting scared and things really start escalating. So I think that this is good tinder waiting for a spark. And you know, it's definitely a good start. I'm pleasantly surprised at the atmosphere out here.
Jeff Smith, thank you very much. Well, I'm sure we'll be talking to you more as Occupy continues on.
Thanks for having me.
I'm standing here with Captain Ray Lewis, and you might recall him as the former retired Philadelphia police captain. He's become a very iconic figure in the Occupy movement. How are you doing today, Ray Lewis?
Wonderful. There's a great crowd, great weather. What more could you ask for?
It's great to see you out here. What brings you out here today?
Once again, I want to show solidarity with all these occupiers because I support them 100% in what they want to achieve, and that's major change in this country.
It's been a long day so far, and it's only probably 10:30. What have you seen so far today?
I've seen a lot of rejuvenated people because, you know, through the year, we haven't been together much, but this anniversary brought everybody back together. It raised our spirits, as you can tell by the jubilation here, and once again, we're on the march.
Where do you see, obviously today the media will portray this as Occupy's big comeback, but a lot of people don't realize that occupiers have been involved in other sorts of forms of activism throughout, and today is sort of, I guess you could say, the revival of the brand Occupy, perhaps. Where do you see Occupy going forward as a movement together?
I see it going the same place it's been going for the last year, and that is we're changing from occupation to education. And that's being done in a whole lot of different areas by smaller groups, but it's also more effective. The actual occupation got us the notoriety, got us the recognition, but now it's time to really get into education, and that's what we're doing.
What type of efforts are you involved in during the rest of the year to educate people in Philadelphia and elsewhere?
Basically, I'm going to be going out to California at a forum just to speak and give my background and why I joined Occupy. I'm going to a fracking demonstration in Philadelphia next Thursday, things of that nature, any type of protest or event that concerns changing this country.
That's great. Do you talk to other retired police officers, active duty police officers? And I'm just curious, are there kind of different perspectives that you get from that community? Your former colleagues, current colleagues?
No, I don't talk to former colleagues. I moved out of Philadelphia 8 years ago to be isolated and secluded up in the Catskill Mountains. And subsequently, I didn't maintain any contact with anyone. But this Occupy movement brought me back into society. I have got comments from the NYPD, and they're not for the public.
It's just... Personally, I find it great to see you out here because it's great to put, you know, seeing someone in uniform, that perspective into this. Because a lot of people don't realize, as these cops are out here, you know, I guess you can say, you know, people see it as police versus occupiers. It's really not when you just look outside of the, you know, the protest, because that's not what it's about.
No, not at all. And I want to just go back one thing and qualify what I said, if it's not for the public. I didn't mean it's none of their business. What I meant is it's not for public ears. It was rather derogatory.
Right.
I understand, yes.
I totally understand.
Thank you very much for giving us your time, Captain Lewis.
Thank you.
Thank you for your service in all ways.
Thank you, guys.
Thanks a lot.
Thanks for what you're
doing. Really appreciate it.
Take care. Have a good day.
Thank you. All right, we've headed out of Bowling Green, which seems to be the meetup point for at least the Occupy group we ended up with. It's maybe a block or two away from the Wall Street Bull. So it's a good position for the occupiers to meet up. There was some mic checks going on, the people's mic. And so we headed down to Zuccotti Park just to get away from everything so we could basically summarize today's events so far. Oddly enough, Zuccotti, where everything went down last week, is completely barricaded in. Everything went down last year is completely barricaded in, with just a few people sitting about, going about their daily business. Security and police all around it. It's a very stark contrast from last year, but you can see the occupiers are still here.
The occupiers are definitely still here, and I think most importantly, the issues that they're raising are still at the forefront. And it's interesting, if you look at what most people are talking about, they're talking about student debt, they're talking about income inequality, they're talking about reining in the financial sector. Really all actually very mainstream concerns that most people are actually really legitimately worried about. So the protests, despite all the images and all the kind of drama of it, the basic concerns and demands are the same, and they're really important. And I think people will keep coming out until they're substantively addressed.
I mean, I think the media narrative you'll hear after today is Occupy Wall Street's comeback, with some trying to say it was a successful comeback, others trying to say it failed. But if you're out here, it's clear that this isn't an Occupy Wall Street comeback. it's a rejuvenation. And I think that's the difference from getting your information from what other people are broadcasting and from being here and seeing it for yourself. I'm Matt Binder.
I'm Michael Brooks.
And this is the 1-year anniversary of Occupy Wall Street.